So, hello everybody again. This is Brooke Stanfield from Region 10. With me is Ted Lanzano from Region 8 and Noemi Emmerich from Region 9. We are going to get started in 1 minute. I just started the recording of this call so that we could keep this for folks that weren't able to attend or go back to it in case we wanted to grab some notes. The conference is also being recorded through the CLUIN online seminar. So there should be, after this, any of us should be able to access the slides and the recording via the web on the CLUIN site. So I just want to do a quick check. Has anybody joined us that has not been able to log on to the CLUIN site to see the presentation? Okay. So I'll go ahead and kind of get started with just a little bit of housekeeping before we kind of jump into the agenda. So this is the fourth RLF best practices call that Ted, Noemi, and I have done since last year. We're dedicating today's call to a review, just an RLF 101, based on some feedback we got from you all at the Western Brownfields workshop last October. So again, my name is Brooke Stanfield. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the Brownfields RLF program lead for Region 10. And for basically since about a little over a year ago, I've been working with my counterparts Ted Lanzano and Noemi Emmerich to provide an ongoing forum for peer-to-peer learning among the RLF grantees in the three Western regions, which is designed really just to supplement what happens once a year at the Western Brownfields workshop. So we'll get started with the slides in a few moments. And while we wait for others to log on, I'll cover a few housekeeping items. For those of you joining us via the phone line, which is most of you, we have two requests. The first is that you put your phone on mute for the seminar. Although the format for today's call won't allow us to be as conversational as we normally like to be, there will be some times when you can take your phone off mute and ask a question. If you don't have a mute button on your phone, go ahead and take a moment right now and you can hit *6, that will put your phone on mute. And then when you want a question, you want to ask a question, you can hit #6 to unmute. So again, that's *6 to mute and #6 to unmute. And that will really reduce the background noise that can disrupt the quality of the transmission. And then the second rule is just please don't put us on hold, because oftentimes different phone systems have music or advertisements, and those can be really disruptive to a call. So before I move on again, I just want to check to see if everybody has managed to log into the CLUIN site and go and get to the seminar. If anybody is having difficulty or just wasn't able to register in time, we have a backup plan in place. So is there anybody that's is in that situation, or is everybody already logged in?
Hello.
Hello.
Anybody there?
Yes.
Hi, this is Glenn and Wally from San Francisco.
Oh, hey, Glenn and Wally.
Brooke?
We just went through the standard conference call housekeeping of the mute and the don't put us on hold. Are you guys logged into the CLUIN yet?
Well, he's not clued in just at the moment.
You're not clued in?
No.
Do you want to? Are you going to be able to do that, or should we send? Do you want a copy of the slides?
We have a copy.
They have a copy. That's great. Fine. They can just participate via conference call. They don't have to be in CLUIN.
Yeah.
Okay. Great. So as we move through, it sounds like most folks have been able to click on the Go to Seminar icon and be on slide number one of the presentation. So you'll see that above the slides are some navigation icons. You can submit a question at any time by clicking that question mark button. This is actually kind of a good way of submitting questions, because you can submit them real time. We can process and respond to questions pretty quickly as we go along. We we will not, we'll just make a practice not to reveal the identity of the questioner. So it, for those of you that feel like you have a sort of a quote-unquote dumb question to ask, we want to welcome those. And then as we move through the presentation, Ted, Noemi, and I will be noting the slide number that that we're moving to. And the slide number should be marked in the bottom right corner in each slide. So, let's see. At the end of the presentation, we're going to talk about a couple of documents that we've put on the RLF Interactive Document Library, also known as the Quick Place site, that we reference in today's presentation. And once again, this seminar is being recorded, so you can access it via the internet afterwards. Both the audio and the slides will be accessible. So before I jump in, just a couple final notes. So because this is an RLF, naturally we're going to be just scratching the surface of a lot of topics, 12 of them. And so obviously we won't be able to get into a whole lot of depth. So if there is something you think we should come back to in more depth at a later date, please jot those down to either email to us afterwards or just shoot them to us in through that question button. And so we'll use that for kind of starting point for the, you know, our next call or whatever. And so I think with that we'll go ahead and get started. And so last call, any problems getting access to the Kluin site and the presentation? Okay. So I'm going to go ahead and pass the mic to Noemi, who's going to start with, well, I guess we've kind of moved, I kind of lied, we've moved through slides 1 and 2, which just provide an overview of the 12 general topic areas we're going to cover today. I'm going to move through those and get ahead to slide number 4, and Noemi's going to talk about the first one, which is setting up an RLF team. Take it away, Noemi.
Hi, this is Noemi Emmerich. I work for EPA in Region 9. I'm the RLF lead in Region 9, and I'm based out of our Los Angeles office. I'm going to start first with just talking a little bit about the team's roles and responsibilities. And there are 4 key roles within the RLF program, first being the EPA project officer, second being the RLF recipient, that would be yourself, the grantee, then the borrowers and the subgrantees. And it's kind of a 3-tiered process, so as you see, the money flows from EPA to the cooperative agreement recipient and then on to the borrowers. And we call the cooperative agreement recipient because we love acronyms. We call those CARs. So EPA's role, what is it that EPA provides? EPA will provide technical assistance not only in setting up your RLF program, but in also every step along the way in documentation, setting up your loans, as well as providing any review of cleanup plans if necessary by working either with your state or your regulatory agency where you're going through the cleanup. We'll also review documents. We have to approve the site and borrower eligibility, which Ted will talk a little bit more in depth about later. We'll monitor all your financial, environmental, and periodic progress reports, and we'll also monitor to ensure that you're complying with all the terms and the conditions of the cooperative agreement. So unlike other funds that you may receive from other federal agencies, which are just considered grants, these are cooperative agreements, which means EPA does have quite a bit of participation or substantial involvement. So now moving on to slide 7, the RLF recipient, what is their role? So the RLF recipient and or the grantee, or also known as CAR, are the individuals who are responsible for administering the RLF program. So it's the responsibility of the CAR to create the RLF program manager or coordinator role, the one person who would be what we call on the key person's contact list, the person who would be corresponding with EPA where they'd have questions about the program. It's also the grantee's responsibility to ensure that compliance with all the terms and conditions are met, both from an administrative standpoint, as well as from the environmental cleanup side, the financial management, and also that you're in compliance with all federal, state, and local laws. So the next slide is there are two key roles that the RLF recipient is responsible for fulfilling. Those are the fund manager and the qualified environmental professional. With the fund manager, move to the next slide. It is the fund manager's responsibility to establish the criteria for selecting your borrowers and subgrantees. They also have to ensure that you have prudent lending practices in place, establish all the types of methods that you'll have for your payment and disbursement, adhere to any eligible cost requirements, and ensure that your cost share as well as your program income requirements are met. So really it's the fund manager, anything that is financially related to the loans, it is their responsibility to manage and take care of. And a fund manager can be someone within your organization. It could be another city department that you bring on to manage your loan process, or you can also hire an outside party. However, if you hire a private outside party, you do have to make sure that you follow the federal competitive bid laws. Also, one of the things that EPA will do is you have to have written agreements set up with both your fund manager and your qualified environmental professional. Those written agreements will be reviewed by EPA, and the reason that we review those is to ensure that your relationship both with your fund manager and with your qualified environmental professional are meeting all the statutory requirements of the RLF program. So with a qualified environmental professional, their role is really to coordinate and oversee site-specific cleanups. So for any cleanups that's going on that are issued through one of your loans, your qualified environmental professional would oversee that. It can be the state agency if you're going through the voluntary cleanup program, but it doesn't have to be a government employee. It can also be a contractor that you may hire to oversee the loanee or subgrantee's work. This person would determine whether the cleanup has been authorized. They would review any public comments and respond along with the subgrantee and or the loanee when the public reviews the remediation plan, and they're also responsible for ensuring compliance with the applicable environmental regulations and laws. So moving on to the next two key roles on the next slide, which are the borrowers and subgrantees. It's the borrowers are not contractually responsible, are contractually responsible to the RLF recipient and not EPA. EPA would not go in and talk to a borrower specifically without having the CAR and or the grantee on the phone. So it is the grantee's responsibility to ensure that the borrower follows all the applicable laws and regulations that are required under the RLF grant. Borrowers can be public and or private entities, and it is the borrower's responsibility to ensure that they clean up the site following the regulatory agency's standards, and that they also document how the fund is being used. But it is, we would not, EPA would not go to the borrower and say, we need this type of information. It would be the responsibility of the CAR to do that. So for subgrantees, these cannot be private parties. These have to be public entities, and the public entity must own the site in order to be eligible for a subgrant. And for subgrants, the funds can only be used for eligible costs under the RLF program. Administrative costs are not allowed for subgrants. And we'll talk a little bit more about subgrants later on in a different area, but just wanted to give you an idea that they also, subgrantees also play a role in the roles and responsibilities under the RLF program. And one other thing that I wanted to mention is that if you have an RLF coalition, the coalition members are eligible to receive a subgrant. It's the grantee, what we call the CAR, who is not eligible to subgrant to themselves, but if you're a coalition member, you are eligible to receive a subgrant. And so that's it under roles and responsibilities. If there are any questions, not, then I'll turn it over to Brooks for the marketing.
So, yeah, we didn't get any questions over the Cluent site, so if you have a question you want to ask over the phone, now's a good time. If not, I will go ahead. I'm on slide 12, which is, well, mark, you know, the title slide for the marketing section, and I'll go ahead and move to slide 13. Is that a question? Okay.
Well, I have a question. This is Tom Coda from DTSC.
Sure.
You mentioned that you have to have a written agreement with the qualified environmental professional. If that person is in-house, obviously there's no written agreement. Do you still just need to document who that person is or who that group is?
Right. It's just a documentation, and oftentimes the documentation can be made on the key contact list, or you can just send something in. It's usually part of the loan materials that are sent in.
Okay. And if,
and within DTS, within DTSC, since you are the grant recipient, that qualified environmental professional may change among staff depending on where the site's located.
Okay. That's fine. Great.
Thanks, Tom. So the marketing piece. So many of you recall the conference call we held last March. You may recall that was a long time ago. But we dedicated that call entirely to marketing. And even though we've discussed marketing in the group, we thought it was an important enough topic that we just wanted to do a quick recap of some of the major aspects of marketing a brownfield RLF program. Once again, I'm on slide 13. So, of course, one of the early deliverables many of you have had or may have in setting up your RLF program is a marketing plan, and these can be relatively detailed or they can be fairly general. But some of the things that emerged from our discussion last March that you might want to remember as you're thinking about your marketing plan or marketing activities include the following. So slide 14. The three main things that we talked about in that call were marketing. It starts with identifying your target audience. And so each of you serve a community that is unique in its challenges and the stages that they're in their evolution in the land revitalization process. There's really no one-size-fits-all approach to marketing. There will be some common characteristics that all of us will share and likely see in projects coming your way from developers or an environmental agency. You might also see, many of you might also have in common having projects coming from through the door of the local government or redevelopment agency. Perhaps your community already has a brownfield inventory, so a lot of you will use that as a entry point for marketing. But we actually heard from some of you that you overlay inventories with key redevelopment areas that might help you identify targets for marketing. But figuring out which groups in your community are the most important to target is really one of your first steps. And then the second step is connecting with that target audience. And here's where you ask yourself what networks your target audience might be linked into and how they're getting their information. And on the call, we heard grantees talk about getting on the agenda at developer breakfast forums or other regular events hosted by local chambers of commerce or business groups. So that worked for some folks. And then there might be some communication channels that would allow you to get the word out to mass audiences. But I vividly recall one person on that call, one of our grantees, saying that most marketing happens one-on-one. And so along those lines, many grantees have tried to develop printed marketing materials and done emailing, but most felt that these weren't really necessary, but it was really getting FaceTime with potential borrowers. But that may depend on your community and target audience. So there's always that variability. The last major thing that came out of that call was delivering the message. And oftentimes, you have a limited opportunity to actually get your message across to that intended audience. And so how do you make the message stick? And so we talked a little bit about that. And one of the take-home points related to marketing and RLF is that your communication approach probably is going to need to be adaptable as you're targeting different groups. Developers are going to speak a different language than planners. And a message that resonates with city staff in urban areas, may not connect as well with rural areas. I think I remember the folks from Washington saying that. There were a lot of you that also talked about just talking about how you've gotten good at softening the communication with potential borrowers so as not to scare them off. And there are a variety of ways to do that. We heard a lot of people that simply internalize in their own internal process a lot of the cross-cutting requirements involved in the federal funding world, so that the borrower doesn't even know that they're in compliance with Endangered Species Act or the National Historic Preservation Act, but it's being handled internally, but then I also remember that when on this topic that I think it was Keisha Schlegel from Missoula said, ultimately, delivering the message and making it stick comes down to whether your loan product meets their needs in terms of dollars and cents. So that's kind of where the rubber meets the road in a lot of this. I guess the next slide really moves to the next topic. Before I pass that on to Noemi, does anybody have any questions on marketing? I guess I had one comment, and that is that, you know, the marketing world may be very different today given the current economic situation than it was even a year ago. And so that's always a topic that we can come back to and talk about how people are adapting. And I'm always interested in hearing what people are up to. So if that's something you're interested in as well, we can certainly facilitate that. But go ahead.
Okay. Me? So we're moving.
Yeah, so Noemi will go ahead and move from slide to slide 16 and take it away on financial management.
Okay, so under financial management, I'm going to start again. I talked a little bit about the roles and responsibilities of the RLF fund manager, but really talked about it in terms of how you set up your team and what the RLF fund manager's role would be. But now that your RLF fund manager has been brought on board, under their financial management piece, what would they be doing during the 5 years or maybe the 3 to 5 years that you have the grant? So one of the first things that is a big responsibility of the fund manager is that they have to maintain all of the accounting records. And so it's not just looking at the budget controls. So for instance, if they realize that money, the way you have it split up in your work plan, some money needed to be taken out of programmatic costs and moved into the loan or subgrant area, then there is a 10% limit that grantees have that they can change their budget without seeking EPA approval. But anything beyond a 10% change, they'd need to get EPA approval through their project officer. And this is also a role of the fund manager. Other things that the fund manager would do was develop internal controls for any type of cash disbursement and revisions for record keeping. So as part of your quarterly report, within your quarterly report, you typically have to give what funds have been spent within this quarter and kind of where you are overall. It's what we call financial reporting. This is where the RLF program manager, the grantee, would contact this RLF fund manager and ask for this type of information. And the fund manager is also responsible for keeping documentation of payroll, time cards, any type of loan and award documents. And the time cards can be really important if the grantee is using program management as part of their cost share, then you'd need to document how many hours the individual was actually providing towards administering this RLF program through either a time card or however the city uses to document employees' time. The fund manager would also be responsible for the payment schedule for any loans and subgrants, as well as any program costs that are being charged to the grant. And they're also responsible for ensuring that any cash management and or drawdowns that are made, that any of the drawdowns that come in the funds, that they're actually needed prior to making the drawdown from the EPA account. So we don't allow for a grantee to pull money out of the EPA account and have it sit within their account for more than 72 hours without having it go out for disbursement. And so that would be the fund manager's responsibility to make sure once the funds are in that they go out very quickly. And then lastly, just ensure that any advances of the loan funds that do come in, that they are placed in an interest-bearing account, and when loans are repaid and that program income money is coming back in, that it is also placed in an interest-bearing account. And so that would be the role and responsibility of the fund manager. So any questions under that? So if not, I'm going to move to slide 17 and talk a little bit about cost share. So as most of you are aware, the RLF grant does require 20% cost share, and that 20% cost share can be in the form of cash, labor, materials, or services. but any of that has to be for eligible costs under the RLF program. So if administrative costs are not considered an eligible cost under the RLF program, so those could not be used as part of a cost share. With your cost share, you do have to make sure that you have adequate documentation to show that you have the 20%. Federal funds typically cannot be used for cost share, except if you're using the HUD CDBG dollars. That's the only federal funds that can be used as a match. Some people, some grantees do decide that they want to pass their 20% share onto their borrowers or subgrantees. So if someone were to come in and ask for a loan for $500,000, you take out the 20% and just give them the loan minus the 20%. One thing I would caution you that if that is the method that you're using to pass along the cost share, is that if you get down the road and you spend a lot of time developing a loan and or subgrant with a particular entity, and then at the last moment they decide that they do not want to take out the loan or the subgrant and end up breaking the agreement, if you were charging your programmatic time to the grant for having set up that subgrant or loan, you as the grantee would still be responsible for paying the 20% cost share on those programmatic income funds that you're drawing down from the grant. So just be sure, if that's the only mechanism you have for cost share, that you consider that possibility if that were to happen. And then program income, such as any loan fees or interest payments that you're getting off of loans or subgrants that you've already made, those can be considered part of your cost share. So that's it on cost share. I don't know if you have any questions. And one of the things that you do need to have your cost share accounted for throughout the life of your grant, but the documentation, you can make up for it kind of at the end. But the idea is, as you're drawing down money, you just have to make sure that you've anticipated where that cost share is going to come from. But the cost share can come at the very end of your grant, right before you're getting ready to close out, by a cleanup that's coming in that may cost, you know, $500,000, but you're only giving a $200,000 loan. It doesn't have to come right at the time that you're drawing down the money. Any other questions? Okay, so if not, then I'm going to pass it on to Ted to slide 18 to talk about prudent lending practices.
All right, thanks, Noemi. Hey, everybody, this is Ted, and I'm the RLF lead here in Region 8. And I'm going to just jump right into my sections here, not hearing any questions on the past sections, starting with prudent lending practices. And basically, prudent lending practices refer to the procedures in place in your RLF program that ensure the sound financial management of your RLF, so you can make sure you're making secure loans to qualified borrowers and you're going to get your money back. Pretty important. These are also the underwriting principles in lending that include interest rates and establishment of repayment terms and fee structures and collateral requirements. It's up to the grantee to implement the lending practices that qualify as prudent, but EPA also oversees this as well. So, and it's really common for grantees or for the cooperative agreement recipient to really not have the expertise and the capacity with the technical aspects of lending. But as part of the overall RLF team, grantees have partnered with other financial organizations, typically public organizations, to assist with the lending process. For example, in Missoula, Montana, the city there has an RLF, and they've partnered with the Missoula Area Economic Development Corporation, I think I got that right, to manage the lending and financial portion of the RLF. And I think they've found that this partnership is pretty valuable, and they rely on this organization a lot through the lending process. So I'm going to go to slide number 19 now. And one of the key aspects to the prudent lending practices is through securing collateral. And the general rule of collateral in your RLFs is that while all loans need to be properly secured, the details of collateral are worked out by the grantee and the borrower, and there is some flexibility there. Collateral for RLF loans comes in various forms, and the idea is to try to be in the best position possible and have the collateral cover as much of the loan as you can. But understand that you may need to be more flexible and assume more risk than a traditional loan. One of the overarching goals of the Brownfields program is to be a catalyst in redevelopment of contaminated sites. And in that kind of role, there are certain risks that are par for the course. And one of the reasons why people want to take out an RLF loan in the first place, in some cases, is because we accept more risk and we're a little more flexible. So with respect to interest rates, grantees can make loans to eligible borrowers at interest rates less than market rates. And again, this is another way to attract borrowers to the RLF. Rates are negotiated out and worked out at the time when the loan is executed, and this is between the grantee and the borrower, but EPA also comments and oversees this process. We've seen a lot of different rate scenarios, and I'm sure the grantees on the phone know a lot about this. But sometimes if the intended reuse of the borrower's site is for open space or public benefit, the rate may be lower than if it's a for-profit company who could have more cash flow coming from the project. And Brooks, Noemi, and I were talking earlier, and we were thinking that lower interest rates for an RLF could be used as an interesting incentive for green remediation at a site, or putting green buildings or LEED certified buildings on a site. And I'm not exactly sure if that's been done to date, but could be interesting if that's that ever does happen. With respect to repayment terms, this is also negotiated with the borrower and the lender at the time of the loan execution. And the key here is to find a balance with payback that meets the needs of the borrower so that they want to take out the loan, but it also doesn't leave you, the grantee, without a repayment for a long period of time. The idea is to have a loan fund that's replenished quickly so you can go out and make another loan and clean up more sites, but also allow flexibility to the borrower so it works for them. And it's kind of difficult sometimes finding that balance. So let's see, that concludes the financial management section. Are there any questions on that area before we go into site and applicant eligibility? I don't see any online here. Okay. Well, not hearing anything, I'm going to move forward. And I'm going to start here with slide number 21, which is eligible, starting with eligible sites. And for a RLF site to be eligible, as with all of our Brownfields grants, the first thing we look at is whether or not it meets the Brownfields definition. I'm not going to read this. I'm sure you guys are all familiar with this. But basically, the key point is that there's contamination on the site that's inhibiting the reuse. So in the next slide, on slide number 22, there are many different types of sites and contaminants that are eligible for loans and subgrants, and this is not really any different than our other Brownfields grants. And some of these can include sites with hazardous substances, petroleum contamination, asbestos, and lead-based paint. We often get the question whether or not asbestos is eligible for RLF loans and subgrants, and it most definitely is. Sites contaminated by controlled substances or meth labs. I don't know if nationally we've ever had a loan or a subgrant that went towards cleanup of a of a meth lab or something like that, but perhaps it has happened. Mine-scarred lands, and there are lots of others. We're pretty flexible with this. So moving to slide number 23, petroleum sites. And if anybody has used Brownfields funding for sites contaminated with petroleum, you probably know that eligibility is a bit more tricky than for sites with hazardous substance contamination or for sites with commingled petroleum and hazardous substance. But briefly, the statutory requirements that need to be met include that the site is of relatively low risk compared to other sites in the state. There's no viable responsible party. The applicant cannot be potentially liable for cleaning up the site, and there's no RCRA order there. Generally, petroleum site eligibility will be determined by the state, But when the state cannot do this, then EPA can also make the determination. So moving to the next slide, I think it's number 24. There are some sites excluded from the brownfields definition and are not eligible. You probably are aware of this. These are listed sites or proposed for listing on the National Priorities List, also known as Superfund sites. Sites subject to enforcement orders or court orders or negotiated settlements and then federal properties are not eligible, BLM, Forest Service, that sort of thing. So. All right, on slide number 25, I'm going to move from eligible sites to eligible borrowers and subgrantees. But I just wanted to stop real quick and see if there are any questions on the phone. Okay, I don't see anything on the computer here, so I'll just keep moving forward. But, okay, so eligible borrowers. Noemi mentioned this earlier. And it, just to expand a little bit, eligible borrowers can be any public or private entity with control or access of the brownfield site. The borrower does not need to own the site that they intend to clean up, and the grantee can give a loan to itself if that is what you want to do. As far as eligible subgrantees, they're limited to local, state, tribal governments, nonprofit organizations, redevelopment agencies, and quasi-governmental entities. These are the similar folks who are eligible to receive the brownfields cleanup grants. So, and private parties are not eligible for subgrants. And I'm going to expand a little bit on that on slide 26. So some of the subgrantee restrictions here. So you cannot give a subgrant to yourself. But as Noemi mentioned, if you are in a coalition, the cooperative agreement recipient can give a subgrant to a coalition member. You must have ownership of the land at the time the subgrant is awarded through the end of the project being funded from the subgrant. And for-profit organizations are not eligible for subgrants. And also with subgrants, you can only subgrant a max of $200,000 per site, and a max of 40% of your total grant can go towards the subgranting, and then the other 60 has to go towards making loans. And, you know, really, subgranting can fill a needed niche here in your program and your financial toolbox, but if you give away your money, your overall ability to make future loans is certainly diminished. And let's see, continuing on with a few subgrant restrictions here, you cannot pair two subgrants from RLS for work on one site. So if you have two different RLF grants, you can't combine $200,000 from each to work on one site. But it is okay to pair a $200,000 cleanup grant and a $200,000 RLF grant. And apparently, I'm told there is a statutory reason behind that. If you guys would like us to look into that, we certainly can. So that is, let's see, it looks like there is a question online here, and I'm just going to read it. It looks like it is from Emeryville, California. And the question is, can the QEP, the Qualified Environmental Professional, if not a state employee and perhaps a consultant, make that determination that the Petro site is eligible? Let's see. I'm pretty, it's my understanding, and Brooks and Noemi, feel free to chime in, but I think that the petroleum determination needs to be made by either the state, and if not the state, EPA, and I don't think a private organization, a private qualified environmental professional, can make that determination.
Right. And Ted, the only thing I'd ask is they can't make the final determination, but they can submit all of the information with which to make the argument the site is eligible to either the state and to EPA, and then it's either one of those two that will make the final determination before you can move forward.
Okay.
Yep, that's my understanding as well.
Great. Okay.
Well, let's see here. Thanks for that question. And I'm going to go to slide number 27. Continuing here with eligible borrowers and eligible subgrantees. So another important factor with eligibility is that the borrower and the subgrantee cannot be considered liable for the contamination that they intend to clean up. Probably already know this, but more specifically, the borrower or the subgrantee cannot be a past owner or operator of the site during the release of contamination, cannot have caused or contributed to the contamination, or been a generator or transporter of the contamination. So, move to the next slide here on slide number 28. So one of the ways borrowers can take ownership without assuming liability is through the all appropriate inquiry process. This is also known as AAI or due diligence. It's also referred to as. There's steps to meet the AAI requirements, and I won't get into all of these, but briefly, they include conducting your phase one environmental assessment prior to voluntarily acquiring the property and taking reasonable steps once you own the property to control any release that's there. So just know that this is something that's done. It's very common in property transactions and also in the RLF world. I included a link there at the bottom of the slide if you need more information on that, or you can talk to Brooks, Noemi, or myself on that too. So, all right, so that concludes site and applicant eligibility. Are there any questions on that section before we move to eligible use of funds?
Hey, Ted, this is Wally.
Hi, Wally.
Yeah, what about lessees of that site? Can they be borrowers or subgrantees if they're a nonprofit organization?
Wait, I'm sorry, Wally. I don't understand your question. Can you say that again?
Okay, you just talked about potential liable parties under CERCLA 107.
Okay.
Can't be a subgrantee or a borrower?
That's correct.
Okay. Now, what about instead of an owner, how about somebody that's leasing something on that site? Because under the 104K cleanup grants, we just found out that those folks are not eligible because they're just merely by the fact that they're lessees on that site, even though they're not the owners or operators doing the release.
Right, right. For cleanup grants, you do need to own the site at the time of the award. For an RLF, you don't have to own the site that you're cleaning up. You could be leasing the site. Does that help, or did you have something else? Brooks or Noemi, I don't know if you want to expand on that.
Yeah, no, what Ted said is correct, Wally. It's completely different for the RLF than the cleanup. The RLF, you don't have to own the site, and for cleanup, you do. So that example, under RLF, they would be able to take a loan. They just they wouldn't be eligible for a subgrant because they don't own the site.
The RLF, you don't have to own the site.
Okay, thanks.
Great, thanks, Wally. All right, any other questions? Okie doke, well, I'm going to move on then and start in here with slide number 30, eligible activities and costs. And really the key point here is that RLF funds are designated for cleanup activities at brownfields. Generally, if the activity is somehow related to the remedial process or the cleanup process or developing your RLF program or your capacity, it's probably eligible. Some examples of, you know, some of the more common activities there on the left of slide number 30 are, you know, removing or preventing a release, capping contamination or removing contamination, excavation, site assessment activities that are related to the cleanup process, so something like confirmation sampling to make sure that your cleanup was effective, and then there are just a few others that I have listed there. As far as eligible costs, these can include cleanup costs, financial management expenses, costs associated with cleanup oversight, Expenses for travel and training, so you can use your RLF grant for to go to the National Brownfields Conference, for example. And fees to enroll in voluntary cleanup program and environmental assurance. And the RLF manual expands on these quite a bit, so if you're looking for a specific cost or activity, it's it could be listed there, or of course the project officer can help with that. On slide 31, there are also activities within the RLF that are not eligible. And on the left there, the activities there, pre-cleanup assessment activities. This question comes up a lot. And typically, you cannot use RLF funds for the pre-cleanup assessment activities. We do have other funds for that, targeted brownfield assessment or our assessment grants that can assist with those. And also, construction, demolition, and development activities not related to cleanup are not eligible. So you couldn't use your RLF funds for vertical development or for hauling away debris or garbage that is not linked somehow to the cleanup process. As far as costs, on the right of slide 31, you probably know this, there's the administrative cost prohibition, and administrative costs are not eligible. So this could include things like accounting tasks and proposal prep costs, record retention, that sort of thing. The programmatic costs, on the other hand, are the ones that are eligible. Other costs that are not eligible include costs at a site where the grantee is potentially liable for contamination, or costs for complying with other federal laws or orders. So, again, encourage you to, there's a big list in the RLF manual if you want to look in for some specifics there, but hopefully that covers the bigger points. So, any questions with eligible costs?
Yeah, this is Ignacio. I have a question, and just more for clarification.
Sure.
It's pretty obvious that you can't use these funds for phase ones, phase twos. Then you have FSRAPs and ABCAs and SAPs for confirmatory sampling. At which part of that continuum can you actually start using cleanup money?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's my understanding you can use the RLF funds for the ABCA, what does ABCA stand for again?
Alternative analysis.
Yeah. As far as the other ones, what were the other ones you listed there?
Well, I had FSRAP, which is sort of like an ABCA or an ECA.
You can
so
use.
So there's a gray area there. And actually, the flip side of that is at what point do you stop using your assessment money if you have both? Up to what point can you use your assessment money, and up to what point can you start using your cleanup money? And is there actually any overlap?
Ted, I can tackle that. The
sure,
idea.
Sure, go ahead.
The idea of when you stop using your assessment, when you start using your RLF, would really part of that would depend on the grantee. You may have more money within your assessment grant that you need to spend, and you may choose to use your assessment grant to do your initial cleanup planning. It is an extension of your phase two, your cost estimates, and you may use the assessment for that, or you may choose you don't have enough assessment funding, and you may end up using your RLF for that. That's really kind of up to you. There is a little bit of a gray line between what's considered, you know, cleanup planning underneath the RLF and what's considered under the assessment. There is some overlap there. But I think talking to your EPA project officer, because a lot of that would be based on a case-by-case basis to answer that gray area, you could talk with them and they would give you a determination. I don't know, Brooks, if you want to add more to that.
No, I think you got it. We see opportunities for overlap here, and it's exactly right. You just want to pick the funding tool that has the most availability to fill the area of overlap. But I'd say that more that times than not, we use RLF to pay for ABCA, for cleanup planning, for all those activities, enrolling in the voluntary cleanup program, because they're all integral to the actual cleanup process. So we use them for eligible expenses a lot.
Thanks.
There's a question online.
There's a question online that's a really good one. Do we want to just go ahead and tackle this right now?
Sure.
Yeah.
So the question is, can an RLF fund or RLF grant be used for a partial cleanup? And that's a really interesting question.
Well, the answer, the way it's written, is yes, and we can pay for only part of a cleanup. But the idea is we're going to ask you where are the remaining leveraged funds to get the site to a full cleanup, because the whole reason we're dispersing our money in the end when you fill out your property profile form is we want the site to get to cleanup complete. So if, in fact, you don't have the remaining leverage funds to clean up the site, then I'm not sure that we would consider that to be eligible.
Yeah.
And it could be timing, too. It's a case by case.
Yeah, and the way I look at it, I'm actually kind of looking at a situation right now where a cleanup is going to be sort of an interim action type deal. It's going to be a phased activity where they're going to do some cleanup, and then as design, final design plans come together, they're going to do a second phase of cleanup. But I think, what we found in that situation is that that our RLF, that borrowers or subgrantees have to enroll in a state voluntary cleanup program. And, typically those involve some sort of agreement. And I don't know, but I haven't seen too many state programs that allow somebody to enter into a cleanup agreement without some sort of final objective that they're working towards. So while I don't want to say unequivocally no, I can't see too many state cleanup programs that would allow that.
Right, and Brooks, not all of our sites go through the state cleanup, so just the regulatory agency that would be overseeing the cleanup. So I think this is another one that is within that gray area. As Brooks said, if it's a tiered approach to a cleanup and you're doing a partial cleanup now and starting some redevelopment, then you're going to come in a year later and do more cleanup to continue with the redevelopment, then that we could see that possibly being eligible. But it would depend.
Good question.
Yeah. Well, Brooks, I'm going to pass it over to you.
Oh, okay. It's my turn, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. So the sixth topic is the EPA review and approval role. And that's slide 32 on to slide 33. As you are all aware, there are many documents that are involved in administering a loan project in accordance with the EPA Brownfields program requirements. And some involve review from your EPA project officer, some involve formal approval, others simply just need to be submitted for our documentation and kept in the file. The purpose of this topic is just to outline the level of EPA involvement in the different kinds of project documents you are typically responsible for in creating, you're responsible for creating in part as part of your loan or subgrant. So keep in mind there's going to be some variation here, at least on the surface, because different states and local oversight programs that you operate within are going to have slightly different, nuances here. But this is a good starting point. And also to complement this section, we've provided you with a more comprehensive checklist developed by another region that covers loan review and approval process in more detail, and that's on our interactive document library, also known as QuickPlace. And I'll be going back over what all we've put in on the QuickPlace at the end. So let's just kind of follow through the order of how a project typically occurs. So the first thing is you have to determine whether your site and borrower and your borrower or subgrantee are eligible. And that's the first line or the first row in that little table on page 33. So as you can see by the X there, EPA must approve this site and borrower eligibility. But in the case of petroleum, as Ted mentioned, the state provides that determination letter oftentimes. Site and applicant eligibility review, there's several things that can happen. And the typical order is you start with a community involvement plan, or some people refer to it as a community relations plan. EPA typically reviews that plan and will provide, you know, kind of comments as a you know, a kind of assistant in an assistance role, but we don't necessarily approve them. And the same goes for the third row, which is the analysis of brownfield cleanup alternatives. We typically review the ABCA and provide comments before it goes out for public comment, but it's not a formal approval role. But I think in general, good practice is to make sure that we have a look at it, just to make sure it's in line with the program requirements. Now, when you get to a cleanup plan, the state or your oversight agency reviews and approves cleanup plans before it goes out for public comment. EPA does not formally review and approve these, but we can often serve as a technical resource, and when asked to review them, we certainly do. So one special note here is that in many states, an ABCA, you know, an alternatives analysis document, is automatically included in their required cleanup plans that go out for public comment. So here in Region 10, some states actually just incorporate that automatically, so we don't require another ABCA on top of that. It meets our requirements, so it's fine. But in some states where they don't require that as part of their state program rules, we just typically create a document that incorporates the ABCA into a cleanup plan, put it out for public comment together as one document so that you don't have to do it twice. And then, once it goes through the public comment process, a decision document has to be made. In many voluntary cleanup programs, the oversight agency will issue a decision document stating which remedy has been selected, and this needs to be submitted for EPA for documentation purposes, but we don't review it, or we don't approve it. In some cases, oversight agencies don't issue these letters, and so in that case, the grantee is responsible for writing up a decision document. And it doesn't have to be too elaborate, but it needs to note that an ABCA was posted for public comment, and whether or not any comments were received, and how they're being addressed in the final selected remedy. I've seen both of those types of decision documents issued by an oversight agency and by a grantee. Now, I think that's the fifth line, the Endangered Species Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. Those are a subset of the federal crosscutters that we're going to go into in the next section. But the point here is just that EPA, this is an area where EPA must determine that the project is in compliance with ESA and NHPA. And we frequently determine that there will be no effects to threatened endangered species or adverse impacts to historic properties, but it is our responsibility to be to comply with those requirements. So once those hurdles have been cleared, your next step is likely getting the loan or subgrant agreement documents drafted, and these are another thing that has to be submitted to EPA for review and approval. And as anyone who has issued a loan knows, this is a critical part of the process. So please provide, please provide EPA with final versions of these documents once it's gone through the back and forth and finalization. The last three on that list, QAPs, Quality Assurance Project Plans. This is, unless your agency has a quality management plan with EPA, and I think the only folks that have that are states, but I could be mistaken. All grantees must provide EPA with a QAP for approval before any field work has been done. I guess unless there's no sampling that's going to take place, but I haven't been involved in too many cleanups that don't have any sampling involved. No further action letters. Once the cleanup is complete, we always appreciate a copy of the final closure or NFA letter from the oversight agency. This is just for documentation purposes. And then lastly, the property profile form. Once the cleanup meets our definition of complete, you submit this either as an actual hard copy or an electronic copy property profile form, or through the online ACRES system. And that form comes to us, and we have to approve it before it can be submitted to our headquarters office and then kind of officially be counted in our reports to Congress and so forth. So there are a couple questions that have come on. Let's see. So can an environmental impact report required by, I guess that's the California Environmental Quality Agency, meet the community involvement plan requirement? And I don't know.
The answer is yes. The answer is yes. Right. The answer would be.
And that's just, typically, there are a lot of our documents actually are sort of incorporated into state programs. They might call them something different, but as long as they meet our requirements and our equivalent, then we don't care what they're called. And your project officer, in this case, Noemi or one of the other folks that work in California, are most going to be able to answer that pretty quickly. Another question that came up is EPA makes the determination on NHPA. Why not the NPS, National Park Service, or SHPO? So the way that the statute is written is that the funding agency the funding agency actually makes the determination. Now, we are responsible for taking certain steps. Before incorporating certain things into our final decision. And one of the basic steps is we must consult with the state historic preservation officer and also affected tribes that are noted that they have an interest in cultural or may have cultural resources in the area. So we have to consult with them, and there are certain rules that dictate how we consult with them and the number of days where they're allowed to respond. I think that it's typically 30 days. But ultimately, that information flows back to the funding agency, and we then have to make the determination, for better or for worse. Sometimes it's a little bit of an intimidating responsibility when you're not necessarily, I'm not an expert on archaeology or anything like that. So sort of as a kind of a sidebar or a side note to that, if the SHPO tells me that they are very concerned, I typically listen, and I'm not going to go out and make a unilateral decision that they're not okay with. But the short answer to that question is that it's just that's the way the statute's written. Did anybody want to add anything to that, Ted, Noemi, or otherwise, or any follow-up questions?
Yep. Tom Stills in Washington State. I'd like a little discussion. It's more, there's a question in there, about EPA's substantive involvement in the review and approval of loan and subgrant documents and how many times this has to take place. In other words, if you've created loan and subgrant documents that have been approved and used before, what is the kind of policy about continually revisiting this aspect?
Well,
because I heard you say is, and what I've read and understood is that once they're approved, you're basically good to go.
Right.
By your project officer. Now we had a change of project officers up here, and so we're adjusting to that.
Right. If I understand your question correctly, we only review a legal, a loan or a subgrant document once, and once we come to an agreement on that loan, then our role is then done. Now, if you're talking about then taking that same document and then just basically using that as your template for the next loan and with no substantive changes and thus not requiring additional review, I just haven't had enough loan. Was that what you were getting at?
Yeah. Well, Brooks, it's not so much the loan. If you're using the exact same loan package, it's not the loan that what you've written within it. If you're using the exact same one we've approved, it's the terms and conditions of that loan that we might be looking at and providing approval on. But if you're using a template that we've already approved, we'll go with that template. It's in that extra information of who that borrower is, what those terms are, what those conditions are, the interest rate. That is what we might look at.
Right. And
I
so
thought that was the responsibility of the cooperative, of the fund manager, to be able to set those terms and conditions. When you say review, what kind of changes? It's difficult, especially if you're working with private sector developers, which we have mostly, well, both up here in Washington. And you have to keep going back and forth with versions of contracts or loan documents between EPA review and then the review by the attorneys of the client. So I guess it's just, I guess for us up here, it's a matter of educating our project officer and coming to agreement on what is appropriate in that
process.
Hello,
anybody out there?
Yeah, we're on the phone.
Yes.
But I think the idea would be under that situation is, remember, EPA reserves, it's a cooperative agreement, so it's substantial involvement. So there is a difference between review and approve. There's a review and comment, and then there's an approve. I think if you're talking with your EPA project officer in advance of submitting anything to your loanee or to your subgrantee and or to their contractor, you can get an idea if what you anticipate proposing to your loan or subgrantee, does pass what EPA would consider prudent lending practices, then you should be okay. But I think it is a case-by-case basis. Maybe your project officer is asking for more, and you could have a discussion with them.
And we are. Thank you.
Yeah. I just actually got a message from Ted saying that he can't hear anything, which is interesting. So let's do a quick check of who's on the phone. Are there folks not besides Tom, Noemi, and me that can hear?
This is Lillian from Great Falls Development in Great Falls, Montana. I can hear you fine.
Okay.
This is Diana Sasser from the city of Sacramento. I can hear you guys just fine.
This is Sarah from Anaheim. I can hear you fine. Thank you.
We can hear you fine in Region 9.
Tom Cutter from DTSC, I can hear you.
Okay.
I'll call Ted on his cell, Brooks. I'll try to. So keep going.
Right.
We're a little behind.
Okay, yeah. Tom, I understand what you're saying, and maybe we can help you with in terms of the outreach to the project officer.
Okay, fine. Thanks, Brooke. I'm back on mute. I'll be quiet
now. All right. That's where we like you.
Hilarious. Now you went dead.
Oh,
yep,
sorry.
Now he's gone.
I'm sorry. I hit the mute button. I don't know what I was thinking there. So I'm going to kind of blaze through the federal cross-cutting requirements.
Brooks, there's a question.
Yeah, there is a question from Tom Cota. Oops. I'm sorry, that's supposed to be anonymous. So for California, and I'll let you answer, Noemi, but I'll just read it. California project, the trigger to the California Environmental Quality Act, would the assessment of endangered species, historic cultural artifacts, and historic buildings meet your needs? What is the timing, and do you want to see draft documents prior to public notice?
I guess meet our needs for what? Meet our needs for the Endangered Species Act?
Yeah, you had the Endangered Species Act, Natural Historic Preservation
mm-hmm.
Act, that you had to approve. So I just wanted to make sure that if we address them in CEQA, which requires us to look at those plus 16 other different topics.
You're covered.
We're covered, but
you're
covered. You want to see that as a draft, because we make those determinations that it doesn't affect the endangered species, both for federal and state.
Right. You have a state agency doing that. We can see the document afterwards because we would come to you anyway.
Okay, I just want to make sure the time. So you afterwards is fine if
right.
after our public notice or when we do it. Okay, great.
Okay. So I guess there are a couple of things. I mean, we're running a little bit behind here, and we actually have a lot of questions about the federal cross-cutters. And so I'm going to kind of blaze through this, but I guess what I'm kind of hearing is that maybe there are enough questions that I'm going to just put a note that maybe coming back to some of these would be worth people's time. But I'll we'll solicit input on that a little bit later. If you go to slide 35, let's do real quick federal cross-cutting requirements. These are requirements of other federal laws, executive orders, et cetera, that apply to federal financial assistance and activities such as the Brownfields program. And then, although EPA retains ultimate responsibility for ensuring that you all comply with the federal cross-cutting authorities, you as the grant recipient often have the direct relationship with the folks that are implementing this, doing the on-the-ground work, like the borrowers and the subgrants. Grantees. So in sum, you know, the compliance activities are carried out in partnership between EPA, grant recipients, and borrowers or subgrantees, depending on the specific requirement in question. So we've talked a little bit about Endangered Species Act. Let's see, what do I have here on slide 36. You know, we talked a little bit about Endangered Species Act. Mentioned that it's EPA's role to make the final determination. If that evaluation is built into some other process, such as the state process that Tom was just talking about, that may be streamlined. Same goes for the National Historic Preservation Act. OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Act, that's where you really, as the grantee, assume more of the burden for making sure that your contract are funding work that is compliant with OSHA. We're not close enough to that level, to that activity, to be able to do that. Davis-Bacon is sort of the same thing. So we depend on you to be in compliance, and we've heard loud and clear that this is something that is a challenge for a lot of you. And so I think that we're going to hopefully see some more information from headquarters this year and some conversation in the coming year, including I think there's going to be a special session just dedicated to cross-cutters at the National RLF workshop that's going to be in June. I'll mention that at the end of the call for those that are unaware. The MeBe-WeBe stuff, which is formerly known as the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Rule, most of you are already doing, and that flows down from an executive order. And then there are others, some obscure ones like particularly for Region 8, like the Marine Mammals Protection Act or the Scenic Rivers Act and things like those. Those are also federal cross-cutting requirements that you're responsible for, they don't cross-cut across our program. So that's nice whenever, you kind of get a pass. And so I think I'd like to kind of keep it going. We have about 15 minutes left, and Ted was going to talk a little bit about record keeping and reporting. Ted, are you back on?
No, actually, that was me.
Here, that's Noemi's section, though.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, Noemi, could you go ahead and you want to go ahead and take that on?
Sure. So I'll start with record keeping. So as part of record keeping, you're required to have a quarterly report, and the quarterly reports are due 30 days after the quarter ends. So for instance, most cooperative agreements start on the beginning of the EPA fiscal year, which is October 1st. Therefore, the first quarterly report would be due on January 30th because the quarter would include October, November, and December. And then, therefore, 30 days later, your quarterly report's due. Within your quarterly report, we do ask that you not only document the progress of your outputs and outcomes and project milestones, but that you also have a budget recap. And the budget recap would include what your current budget is, what cost you have incurred within the quarter, what cost you have incurred to date, and then any remaining funds you have. And the regions may have templates in order for you to follow so that you would have you'd know what information EPA is looking for. So if you've not used a template in the past and you're interested, then you might want to ask your EPA project officer. The other thing that we do require is that you complete a property profile form, and hopefully all of you are signed up to use ACRES and that you're completing this information and putting it online directly. And one of the main reasons for using ACRES and property profile forms is there are certain measures that we have to capture within the reporting that we ask of you, such as how many acres have you cleaned up, what funds have been leveraged, what types of contaminants have been cleaned up, what jobs have been leveraged. And all of this is important for us because we have to report our results back to Congress, and obviously the higher our results are, the more money we have to then pass along to you. Another thing with the quarterly reports is that your EPA project officer will review the quarterly report and may ask you for questions or ask for clarifying documents. And this is basically just to ensure that the outcomes and the outputs that are listed within your work plan are being met. So with that, that kind of ends the record keeping. And now I just want to talk a little bit about record maintenance. We have had questions in the past about how long do you need to maintain your grant records once your grant agreement is closed out. It's need to maintain it for at least 3 years after submitting that last final report to EPA. But before you destroy any records, you need to make sure that you obtain the EPA approval after that 3 years. Additional record keeping may be necessary under the RLF, particularly if you have a closeout agreement. So if, in fact, your grant closes out before some of the loans are repaid, EPA may require that you keep record keeping longer to be able to document how those funds are being spent and to ensure that you're meeting the requirements under the closeout agreement. And grant records are not subject to the for the RLF are not subject to the Federal Freedom of Information Act, which is our FOIA Act, and a lot of that is because of specific confidential information that may be found within loans and subgrants. And then lastly, talk a little bit about auditing, that grantees are required to secure an outside auditor to conduct periodic program audits. A lot of times city requirements already have this in place where they'll have another department or they have an outside agency come in and audit the grant files just to make sure that you are being kept up to date and that you are doing what's required of you. One of the things is that this outside auditor is not considered an eligible cost and it cannot be paid for with grant funds. The other thing is that the grantee is responsible for ensuring that the subgrantee and the borrowers comply again with all those terms and conditions which are within the RLF. So, for instance, if you end up issuing a subgrant, you do have to demonstrate that that subgrantee does have ownership of the property, and it may be that your project officer will ask for a title to show that the ownership is there. So both the EPA project officer would keep it within their file as well as the grantee would keep it within your files. And so those are the main requirements under record keeping for the RLF. Are there any questions?
No, Amy, this is Tom. How often do you have to have the audit? Is there a minimum audits or something like that?
There's no specific time frame that's laid out. It just says that you have to conduct periodic auditing. So we don't want to put an extra requirement. The state agency may have it once a year, or cities may have it every 6 months.
Okay, thanks.
So, yeah, and so the question was asked if a single audit report that's completed on a yearly basis, is that sufficient? And yes, that is.
And this is Dave Shetterly from Region 8, and, mm-hmm. one clarification from Naomi was, your records are not subject to FOIA. Our records are subject to FOIA.
Right.
And we can also claim certain exemptions to withhold certain things.
Right. Correct. Thank you for that. Okay, so with that, I will pass it on to Ted to talk about program income. Ted, are you there?
Okay. Yeah, I'm here. Can everybody hear me okay? Our phone actually died, and we're using a cell phone now. All right. Well, I'm going to move forward here with the program income discussion, and I am now on slide number 42. And basically, the question that comes up a lot is, what is program income? And basically, this refers to the funds that have come back to the RLF after you have made your loan or your subgrants. These are the principal repayments, the interest you've earned. It's everything that's come back to your RLF or income generated. It's the grantee's responsibility to track program income. So let's go to slide 43, just a few examples here of what program income includes. Again, it's the principal repayments, interest earned on outstanding loan principal, loan fees, closing fees, or other income generated from your RLF operations. funds that have come in after the grant has closed out and EPA has gone away are by definition not considered program income because that is outside the award time. So you can use these funds as you agreed to in the closeout report. On slide 44, there are a few things to know about program income because they operate a little bit differently than your traditional grant funds. And generally, it's that you have more flexibility with program income than you do with your regular grant funds. The first bullet there is the grantee needs to loan or subgrant program income before you use your grant funds. So if you make a loan and get paid back, but you still have some grant funds, original grant funds, you need to use your program income first. Program income is not subject to the 40% subgrant limit. I mentioned earlier with the original grant funds, you can max a total of 40% of your grant. But with program income, a grantee could subgrant 100% of that if that's what they wanted to do. Let's see. Program income is still subject to the $200,000 per site limit on subgrants. So you couldn't subgrant any more than $200,000 per site with program income. That rule still stays the same. And program income no longer needs to follow the original petroleum and hazardous substance budget. So when you applied for the grant, you said that, for example, 25% will go towards petroleum and the remaining will go to hazardous substance. With program income, it loses that petroleum color, and you could loan it out as 100% petroleum if you wanted or 100% hazardous substance. So that is what that's really all on program income. I don't see any questions online. Anything from the phone?
Yeah, I got one. I'm Tom Stills in Washington State. The first bullet, grantee needs to loan subgrant program income before using grants. If you have a program and you don't make any grants, then you would use all of your program income, your budget, your approved budget, to pay for your approved costs. Once you do have a loan that comes back in, you can no longer access your approved budget, for example, for administration. You have to use program income, which decapitalizes your revolving loan fund. Is that correct?
Well, so once you make a loan and you get paid back, what you get paid that...
Well, you're getting partial payments, yeah. Paying back, a loan is paying back, I should say.
Yeah, then that's considered program income. And then when you make a subsequent loan, you have to use that first, and then you can tap into your grant funds.
Okay. Okay, so you would, yeah. So okay, I understand that then. So if I make a loan tomorrow and I've got $200,000 in the bank repaid, and this new grant is for $300,000, I first have to use the $200,000 of program income, and then I can draw down from EPA, assuming I still have funds left in the budget line for loans and grants, that other $100,000 or $200,000, whatever my example was. In other words, you spend it first for the new loan or subgrant. So you would drain, for example, in my case, if I had $200,000 in program income and I made a $500,000 loan, then I would spend all of my program income and then come back to the EPA grant for $300,000.
Yes. Yeah, I lost you on some of the details there, but I that last sentence is correct, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And if you have two different RLF grants, you could still loan out the original grant funds from the second RLF grant without considering the other RLF grant that has program income back in it.
Yeah, okay. Thank you.
Sure.
So that's kind of a good segue to the topic 10. But I'll go ahead and cover that, which is the slide 45, amendments and policy in RLF policies. However, we're down to about 5 minutes, and so I think what we're going to have to do is kind of just maybe do a quick overview of the last three topics, which I think we can probably do, and then just wrap up, because I think that our clue-in site might drop us, or the recording might drop. And so we can maybe stay on the phone a few more minutes, but And we can always come back to these, and we will be following up with you probably via email after the call. Really, just briefly on page on slide 46, you know, we do have a new a policy that governs amendments. It allows projects period of 15 years, but there's some nuances to that, and it right now it basically comes down to we can continue to extend grants for up to 15 years, but it's not just for grants that because there's still money that needs to be drawn down. It's really when you've already drawn down money, and you still have demand for more funds. You're applying for supplemental funding. You're getting that, and then continue to issue loans. Every time you're awarded supplemental funds, we can extend your grant. On slide 47, we do have a closeout policy. Ted talked a little bit about this. The last policy, the amendment policy, this closeout policy, and then the policy on page slide 48 on discounted loans, I put all of those on the QuickPlace site for any of you to go ahead and open up and look. And so we've kind of, I think we've covered a few, all of these in some regard either today or in previous calls, and we can come back to them on another call if there are some questions. 49, Noemi was going to talk about supplemental funding. That's pretty timely, so I'll pass it back to her.
Sure, just really quickly, since we don't have much time, the supplemental funding you should have received from your EPA project officers is now out. The monies are available to any new rules RLF grantees. If you meet the certain considerations I'm going to talk about in a minute, your letter has to be postmarked by February 11th, and make sure you send that to your RLF lead within the region. So for Region 10, it would be Brooks. For Region 9, it would be myself, Noemi, and for Region 8, it would be Ted. So some of those special considerations that have to be met in order to be eligible for the supplemental funding is you have to have successfully issued a loan and or subgrant. You have to have substantially depleted your existing RLF fund. So if you have $1 million and you've only put out a loan for $50,000, that may not be considered substantially depleting your RLF funds. You have to demonstrate a need, include the number of sites and what the community benefit is. And ideally here, you don't have to have a site-specific site. I've been asked that question. But just need to show that there is a need, particularly within a redevelopment area because of the way that development might be moving along. But you don't have to have a specific borrower site when you're applying for supplemental. And you have to illustrate that the RLF grant will address cleanup funding gaps. So for instance, within California, one good example you could use is the Cal Reuse Program is no longer available, and that offered quite a bit of funding for remediation. So RLF grants are now really being able to fill the gap for cleanup funding. And also be able to demonstrate how you will, what the community benefits are, how the loan would work and fit into any long-term planning you have in the city, kind of demonstrate what the economic as well as the open space benefits or any affordable housing that might be built following any LEED standards or ordinances that your city might have. And then lastly, the funding, if awarded, you will have to update your cooperative agreement. You'll work with your EPA project officer, and your work plan would also have to be amended to show the new funds. Make sure when you're submitting your request for supplemental funding that you say which kind of funding you want, how much you want for hazardous substance, how much you want for petroleum. Supplemental funding awards are usually anywhere between $200,000 to $500,000. But one of the things is that may actually increase this year due to the economic stimulus package funds that may be coming out. We may have a possibility to put more funding into supplemental awards. So for those who are on the fence about applying, if you have issued a loan or a subgrant and you have areas where you know redevelopment is right on the fringe, I would definitely recommend that you apply for the supplemental funding, given that we probably will have substantially more funds to be able to give out. So that's it on the supplemental funding. Are there any questions?
Okay. So we are at 11:30. I think that to really to close this up, on slide 53, the topic is closeout. Well, again, that kind of goes back to the closeout policy that I talked about a few minutes ago. Adding to Noemi's notes on kind of what's going on, the current happenings in the program, there's the whole stimulus package and how that might affect supplemental funding. We've also been trying to work on our own closeout policy and program income policies to help make those more flexible. We should have those some more information on those efforts sometime this spring, which sort of leads to the final news, and many of you are already aware that we will be having a national RLF grantee workshop in Minneapolis, Minnesota, June 2nd through the 4th. So mark your calendars. It's kind of going to be sort of in the same sort of format, I think, as the Western Brownfields, very grantee-driven. Grantees have been driving the agenda, and it's going to just be very peer-to-peer kind of information exchange. Hope you all can make it, and you'll be hearing more from us on that. And then lastly, the Quick Place site, if you've kind of lost track of your password or whatever and need to get that updated, send Ted, Noemi, or me an email. We'll get you linked back. But we put this presentation up there, all the policy documents that we talked about. I put a model budget and program income tracking sheet, some project approval checklists. I'm on page slide 56. And then we'll probably put a couple of other things on there before the day's over. And so we're trying to keep that alive and useful to you. And then I guess lastly, there were some good questions, and I think that maybe the next time we get together, we will make it a little more interactive again like we normally do. And I think that's it. There is on the last slide, number 59, there is a feedback form if you want to provide feedback on, I think it's more for the clue-in than us, but I guess you can go ahead and provide feedback on us. I'm sure we'll get it. So otherwise, we always take feedback directly or any way you choose to get it to us. So thank you all for participating.
Brooks, real quick.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add, there is an evaluation sheet there, and it's for the, you know, the content of the presentation, and we would certainly love to hear from all of you. So please take a few minutes right now and fill it out. You'll see it on the main page of the that you saw when you came online for this clue-in seminar.
Thanks, Ted. Yeah. So again, we'll be following up with you all to see what the next get together, what we'll be covering, and one thing I will promise is that it'll be a little bit more interactive. We wanted to respond to people's interest in having the one-on-one, but I think that we'll probably continue to try to get more conversation going between you all as we continue to convene this group. So anyway, any final remarks? Okay. Thank you all. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye.